Do the Apostle Paul and the writer James contradict each other? That has been answered in the affirmative by several. In fact, there have been some who have said it is so contradictory that the epistle of James has no business within the New Testament, that it is a false epistle, that it is going completely against what Paul says and therefore should be dismissed in very short order. If this, however, is the case, I believe we find the entire New Testament collapsing, because we find that these two men, in their presentation of material, if indeed they are contradicting, show us that the Bible cannot be trusted, that we've got things in the Bible that we must decipher and throw away. And I hope that you're like me and you totally disagree with such reasoning as that. No, the Apostle Paul and James do not disagree. In fact, we're going to see this evening, I hope, that they are very much in unison within their thoughts. The reason I have determined to do this lesson this evening is because for the past several weeks, the sermons at least that I have been preaching have focused on the idea of doing good work in the Lord's service. We went through an entire series on the one another passages, and we talked about we are to show one another that forgiveness and that love and bear with one another and be busy in good works. Not too terribly long ago, we talked about the 52 days of Nehemiah, and a challenge was issued to all of us to come up with a very good work of God that can be performed in those 52 days. And by the way, deadline's coming up, July 15th. As we think about all of these things then, we need to consider what the New Testament tells us about works. We need to understand how this fits into the picture of salvation. There are those who will accuse some who hold our beliefs that we are a religion of works. And to be quite honest, I don't know that I disagree with that. However, I would want to put a little disclaimer to let me define what that means rather than to have the definition pinned on me. And so this evening, what I'd like for us to do is to look at what both of these men tell us. And then after we look at those things, understand what they have to say, I want us to come back and talk about two major pitfalls that we can fall into if we're not awfully careful when it comes to our religion in thinking about these ideas of faith and works. So let's begin with what the apostle tells us on the idea of justification. I appreciate Brandon's prayer tonight. And one of the things he prayed as he led us was for thanksgiving, for the justification that the Lord gives. What does that mean? Well, let's begin by talking about what was going on in the days of the Apostle Paul, as well as the early days of the church. We understand that one of the major problems that was presented in the earliest days of the church was the Judaizing teacher. Here was one who, yes, had become a Christian, but he wanted to bring the law with him. He wanted to bring all of these things from the Jewish religion with him. And in fact, we find his main idea was to simply turn the church of our Lord Jesus into just another Jewish sect. They wanted very much an exclusiveness there with the Jews. And the idea of Gentiles coming in, while they supposed that might be okay, it had to be by Jewish standards. Thus we find in Acts chapter 15 and verse 1 where it says, "But some men came down from Judea and were teaching the brothers, 'Unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved.'" Now listen to what they're saying here. They're saying, okay, if you want to be a part of this group, you've got to bring in all of these different things, and you've got to be like us. You got to become a Jew. Well, as the Apostle Paul was confronted with these kinds of things, he stood against them. And we find that in his standing against them, what he's going to do is to show the Jews, look, you are in the exact same boat as the Gentiles. Though, yes, you were a chosen people of God at one time, as we think about Christianity, you are in the same boat. And much of what we find in the initial part of Romans is going to describe that. Romans chapter 3 is going to show that both Jews and Gentiles are sinners. Go ahead and look over to Romans chapter 3, if you will, and we're going to be looking at several verses here as we go through. Romans chapter 3, we'll just summarize up to this point. The Jews have sinned, the Gentiles have sinned. All are in the same situation here. And thus, because of that, because they are all sinners, all in need of salvation, Jesus Christ is the answer for both. So we look down to verse 21 and it says, "But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there is no distinction." Now that's going to be a typical Pauline message, isn't it? We're neither Jew nor Gentile. We're neither male nor female. We're all in this together. We are one in Jesus Christ. So here in the initial part of the book of Romans, what he's saying is, Jew, Gentile, you need Jesus. So because of that, many Jews became upset. Their idea was, if we're going to find salvation, we're going to find it in the old law, and even if we're Christians, we're going to bring much of that with us. And therefore, the apostle is going to continue on, and he's going to talk about a very false notion that many of them were holding on to, that they were being justified by this law, that as they were following the law of Moses, they were earning their place into God's good graces. After all, we're the people of God, we're obeying His law, therefore we are justified. And thus we come to Romans chapter 4. And as we look at Romans chapter 4, what we're going to find here is that Paul says, I want you to think again on that. Let's look beginning in verse 1. "What then shall we say was gained by Abraham our forefather according to the flesh? For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the Scripture say? Abraham believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness. Now to the one who works, his wages are not counted as a gift, but as his due. And to the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted as righteousness." So here's our distinction. The apostle says, let's talk about the idea of earning your salvation. He says, if that's the case, then you are owed something. You have wages due to you. But the one who is justified by God, it's a gift to him. And Abraham is brought out to the forefront as an example. So this morning we talked about Abraham. And we looked at all of these things that God promised to Abraham, and Abraham believed in God. And so the apostle says, look, the reason Abraham received these things was not because he was this great man. He was a good man. And I think even when he was called, he was a good man. But nonetheless, Abraham realized that he could not earn this salvation. And that's the point that the apostle is bringing out. And thus, if we go down to verses 9 and 10, he makes the point that this all happened before circumcision. Verse 9, "Is this blessing then only for the circumcised or also for the uncircumcised? We say that faith was counted to Abraham as righteousness. How then was it counted to him? Was it before or after he had been circumcised?" It was not after, but before he was circumcised. So here are these Jews, and they're saying, God owes us. We're doing the right thing. We've been circumcised. We bear the seal of the covenant. And Paul says, let's think about Abraham. Abraham received these blessings before that. So in other words, the apostle is saying he was not saved by this idea of the law-keeping aspect. He gives the same example for David. You back up just a bit, verse 6, "Just as David also speaks of the blessing of the one to whom God counts righteousness apart from works, blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man against whom the Lord will not count as sin." Now let's think about those two men. If you ask any of the Jews, name your two heroes of faith, Abraham and David would come out. And yet both of these men are used as examples of those who had to cast themselves on the grace of God. Here were those who were not seeking salvation by perfect law keeping, but rather by the grace of God. Now, as you and I consider that, I want us to think about this idea of justification. I want us to think about what that means in terms of what Paul is talking about and later what James is going to talk about. So let's imagine what makes us, us. All right, so we're going to put everything together, and there might have been other things you would add to this list, but we're talking about our deeds and our actions and our thoughts and our work and our participation and our attitudes and our ethic and our morality, our values, our integrity, whatever makes us, us. Now, what does the idea of justification mean? We could go through an entire list of very technical definitions. We could go through some of the more common phrases. Some people say, think about justify as just if I never sinned. And all of those are good. But I want to do something with you a little more simple tonight. When in 21st century American culture do we typically hear the word justify? It's with our margins, isn't it? When we're doing a Word document, we talk about justifying our margins. And so if I click the button and it says justify left, it means everything is going to line up along the left side. Or if I click the button and it says justify right, everything's going to line up against the right side. Okay, I want you to get that picture in your mind, and we're going to justify a couple of margins. Let's justify with the idea of merit. We're lining up everything that makes us, us, by the justification of self, about what we can do. And if you'll notice there, those two letters are in red for a purpose, because I want us to understand the me in this. I am justifying myself. And so what I say is, I am going to be a good guy, and I'm going to have good deeds, and I'm going to have good actions, and my thoughts are pure, and my work is going to be good, and my participation is good, etc., on down the line, and my morality, and my values, my ethic, everything, I'm going to justify by my integrity. And so I set out then to be a perfect person. What happens? Well, as we're going to see in a few minutes, no matter where we started out, we've all ended up in the same position. Because we suddenly learn, I'm going to make a mistake. Okay, I'm going to make a mistake. But yet I understand that with this attitude, what I'm saying to God is, you're obligated to save me. Because if I can line myself up by my standards, and I can be perfect by my standards, and I am the one who's doing the good deeds, and I am the one who's ethically moral, and I can do all of these things, you owe me salvation. That's exactly what the apostle was saying. When he says, if you do it by your standards and you get it right and you get it perfect, yes, there's an obligation there. God is going to pay you. And it seems that many of the Jews had come to that idea, that they were thinking in those terms. We have been circumcised. We have kept the Sabbath day. We have observed the Passover. Therefore, God is obligated to us. We have earned that salvation. But now let's change our margins. Let's justify now to the right. And we've got the same things. We've got the deeds, the actions, thoughts, works, participation, everything. But what I come to realize, that if I'm trying to please God all on my own and apart from Him, I am in a difficult strait. And so the apostle says, look, there is grace that is going to justify. And what that means for us then is that we are justified not by our merit, not by all of the good that we have done, but because there is a gracious God in heaven who looks down at a group of people who are imperfect, who have messed up, and He says, okay, I can help with this. And I'll refer us back to chapter 3 and verse 23 to a very important verse in all of this where it says, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. I tell you, I believe that's what God wanted the Jews to understand with the law of Moses. He gave this very meticulous law, and He says, okay, you want to be like me? Here's what you do. Verse after verse after verse after verse after verse. And then what does he say? And if you mess up, here's the sacrifice. It was giving a picture that even in those days, there could be the idea of grace that if we mess up, there is a God who cares for us. But now with all of that in mind, all of these things considered, I ask you a question. Did Paul ever teach that we have no responsibility in this matter? You'll hear this discussion given sometimes, and the discussion will go something like this. Well, we can't earn our salvation, and I agree fully with that. We can't. And we've messed up, and so we've blown our chance, and I agree fully with that. But then someone says, there is absolutely nothing we can do. And I don't agree with that. Because what we're going to see is the Apostle Paul, as well as James, telling us, oh yes, there is a responsibility that you have. But let me say this right off the bat, because we have responsibility does not negate the grace of God. Because we have things that we are to do doesn't eliminate the fact that we are saved by the grace of God. If this is what Paul taught, he contradicted Jesus and he contradicted himself. Let me point out a verse that I think brings this out so clearly. As Jesus was speaking, he said this. Jesus answered them, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent." Now I want you to pay real close attention to the wording there. There are a lot of folks who believe in belief-only salvation, but I want you to note what the Lord calls that. He says, "This is the work of God." Is the Lord going to save us if we don't believe in Him? Hang on for James as we answer that question. But pay attention to what the apostle says also. As he writes to the Ephesians, he says, "For by grace you have been saved through faith." Again, here is something that man must do. Man must have that faith. Is the apostle saying, well, faith negates grace? Of course not. But what he's saying is, you not only must believe, you must have faith in what's going on. And he continues on. He says, this is not your own doing. We're still not justifying by merit, are we? We're not going to present ourselves to God and say, look at me, I believed in you. Look at me, I had faith in you. You owe me. Of course not. It's blasphemous, isn't it? The apostle says, just because you have faith, this isn't of your own doing. We look at what he says to Titus. For by grace, the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people. What? Training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age, waiting for our blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ. Does that sound like something that man has a responsibility in doing? Yes, grace has come. The grace of God has appeared. It has brought salvation. What? So that we renounce ungodliness. What? So that we renounce worldly passions. What? So that we live under a self-controlled way, upright, godly. Are we doing that so that when the Lord greets us, we can say, Lord, let me check the list off. I was upright. I was godly. I was not worldly. No. That grace, though, is saying, you've got a responsibility in this. So as we consider this, Paul's point is this. That if one has sinned, there is no being saved by merit. When we commit our first sin, the idea of perfect law-keeping is gone. That's why the apostle says, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Every one of us is messed up. None of us is going to keep the law perfectly. None of us is going to show up on the day of judgment and the Lord's going to say, well done, good and faithful and perfect servant. You've not made a single mistake in all of those years. No. We've all sinned. And we've all fallen short of the glory of God. And no matter how much good we do, we cannot undo the bad. Have you ever known someone who's thought in these terms? Here is somebody who has done something just horrible. And what do? They become involved in lots of good works. You might notice this with your kids sometimes. You know, this is always a telltale sign that a child has really messed up when a lot of good is done, right? All of a sudden the room is clean and the car is washed and the garage is swept. All these things. Why? Because it's the idea I've done this bad thing and maybe if I do enough good, it'll cover that sin. And you know, for parents that might work. But not for God. Because with God, what we have done is we violated our covenant with Him. We have sinned. And so it's only by His grace that we can find salvation. But never does the apostle dismiss the idea of obedient faith. Never does he say, well, God's grace is going to cover everything, so go your way and just have a big old time. In fact, it appears there were people who took him in that way. And Paul was misunderstood. In fact, we go over just a chapter or two to chapter 6 and verse 1. And I don't know if Paul is dealing with a specific here or if in his mind he's picturing where some people are going to go. But there are those who are going to say, well, look, Paul, if we're saved by grace and all of this, what shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin so that grace may abound? If God saves me because I'm such a bad guy, let me be a little worse. Let me do a little more wrong, and the grace of God is going to shine. I imagine there may have been some folks who earnestly believe that. If my sins magnify the grace of God, let me keep on sinning. I imagine there were others who said, this seems like a pretty good escape route. Here is the idea that I can just keep on keeping on the way I am. I can live like I want to live. And that is just simply not the case. We continue on, and what does the apostle say? Verse 2, by no means. How can he who died to sin still live in it? Do you not know that all of us who were baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into His death? We were buried, therefore, with Him by baptism into death, in order that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, we too might walk in newness of life. For if we have been united with Him in a death like His, we shall certainly be united with Him in a resurrection like His. The apostle says, really? Can you even fathom the idea that you have died to sin and you say, well, to glorify God, to let His grace shine, I'm just going to keep right on doing what I'm doing. No, we justify the margin by God. And because God has saved us, the idea then is, I want to do everything I can to be pleasing to Him. I want to do everything I can to show His love, to show my love for Him. And so never, ever, ever did Paul teach the idea of inaction. And that's where James picks up. Far from contradicting what the apostle is saying, James is complimentary, and he's going to take that idea and he's going to take us a little further with it now. And James is going to tell us in all of this that you must make sure that your faith is genuine, that your faith is real. And so we might just simply say that James is echoing that idea of obedient faith by describing counterfeit faith. I recently heard a sermon that was very interesting to me. It was talking, the man used an example of counterfeiters and how they're caught. And as the T-men are trained to try to go out and find that counterfeit money, how would you think they were trained? We would be tempted to say, well, it's by studying the counterfeit currency. You know, it's by looking at the latest trends. It's by noting what the counterfeiters are doing. And in that, we would be absolutely wrong. The way that someone learns to spot a counterfeit bill is by studying the real thing. Hours, I understand, are spent by these people looking at real money. And because they have spent so long looking at real money, as soon as a fake comes, they got it. They see the difference there. James is saying, okay, you've had a good discussion on real faith, on what that means. Now let me describe to you counterfeit faith. And he says by that, first of all, it is a dead faith. We know the passage well, don't we? We're going over to the book of James chapter 2. And as we look over here, James is going to tell us This is the idea of a dead faith. Verse 15, if a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Okay, here's counterfeit number one. Somebody says, oh, I've got faith. I've been saved. And here is a good work to be done. Person says, I don't have to do that. I've been saved by faith. I don't have to do that kind of thing. James says, your faith is dead. You have no faith. He goes a step further. He says, not only is counterfeit faith dead, it's also demon-like. We go down to verse 19. You believe that God is one. You do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Someone says, all you got to do is believe. That's all there is to it. What does James say? He says, well, that puts you in the category of demons. They believe and they shudder. But he says, if that's all you think there is to it, your faith is dead. And in verse 20, he says, do you want to be shown, you foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless? Dead? Demonic? Useless? Does that sound like something that would save someone? Does that sound like something justified by God? No. And interestingly enough, guess who James is going to use as an example? The same man the Apostle Paul used, and not only the same man, the same example from the same man. Here is Abraham, and Paul and James are both saying, let us show you Abraham, and let us use him as an example for how this all fits together. They both use the exact same phrase here in James chapter 2, verse 23. We find also in Romans 4 and verse 3, where it says, Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. That comes from Genesis chapter 15, verses 5 and 6. He brought him outside and said, look toward heaven and number the stars. If you are able to number them, then he said to him, so shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him for righteousness. Was Abraham justified by faith? Yes. What if he had said to the Lord, Lord, I don't believe you can do it. I'm an old man. Don't have any children. My wife's old. I don't think you can do it. God would have been finished with him. That would have been rebellion. But Abraham had faith. Is that faith all that Abraham needed? Well, that's all in how you ask that question. Yes, that's all he needed, because that's the faith that took him to then do what the Lord had him to do. We think about James's second example in verses 21 and 22. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up his son Isaac on the altar? You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was completed by his works. What if Abraham had said, Lord, I believe you. Yes, I believe you, but I am not going to Canaan. Lord, I believe in you, but I am not offering my son. That is going too far. Abraham wouldn't have had faith, would he? He could have said it all day long. He could have said all day long, I have got lots of faith. But what James is pointing out to us is this. It was an obedient faith. There was nothing counterfeit about it, and there was nothing meritorious about it. I can assure you that on the day of judgment, Abraham is not going to stand before God and say, remember me, I'm the one who left Ur of the Chaldees, I'm the one who lived in the land that I didn't know anybody, I offered my son Isaac. That's part of his faith. His obedient faith. And therefore, when we're talking about a genuine faith, it is active and complete. Paul and James didn't disagree. Paul and James were on the same page, singing the same song. Neither of them believe one can earn salvation, but neither of them believe that salvation has no responsibility for us, and neither believe that responsibility negates God's grace. Well, let's take all of this and let's make a practical application now. As we think about all of these things, there are two potholes that we've got to avoid. One is that as we think about salvation, it is very easy to believe in a counterfeit faith. And I think that's something that plagues us. Many times we can convince ourselves everything is okay, everything is all right, because we're looking at the counterfeit bill. Here is a faith of one who professes belief, but does nothing in the service of God. We didn't look at James' other example of Rahab. Let me ask you, what if Rahab had closed her door to those spies and she had said, "Yes, I believe in their God, but I want nothing to do with these men"? She would have died. With all of the other Jerichoites, she would have been gone. What? Her faith not only professed belief, but followed through with action. And so we understand that our faith is dead if we see no place for work. Our faith is dead if we can say, "Oh, God has no expectations of me. I can come to church, I can fill a bench." But the idea of actually working, that's not something that I have to do. And I'll reiterate, faith is proved genuine by faithful obedience to God. No work is too great, no work is too hard when we're justifying the margin by God's grace. When we're saying, "Because of what you have done for me, I want to do everything I can for you, not because I'm earning, not because it's making me look good, but because I love you." That's what obedient work does. That's the reason for it. But let's think about that second pothole. It's avoiding the work merit pitfall. And I believe there is a strong temptation for us at times to believe that our good works are earning salvation. That if I can do enough good in this life, then God is going to be obligated to save me when I get to heaven. I don't know that we ever say it that overtly. But if we are not very careful, we can fall into that trap of believing those things, and that when good is done, we are meriting God's favor, and thus we are justified by self rather than God. Let me give you an illustration. By the way, I don't want to hear from any Boy Scouts or any Boy Scouts parents after this, okay? I'm sure I'm not getting all the details right, but stick with me. Here is a young man who becomes a Cub Scout. He decides he wants to join the organization, and he's got a goal in mind. And so he joins the Cub Scouts, and the next phase, his hair turns red and he becomes a Boy Scout, right? So here he is, he's now a Boy Scout, he's gone to the next level. And he continues on, 17, 18 years old, he becomes an Eagle Scout. And here he is at the top, the epitome of what you can become as a Boy Scout. Does anybody think he has gotten that by the grace of the Boy Scouts? No. Because on his sash, or whatever, his shirt, are all of these merit badges. He's camped out. He's helped somebody. He's taken a first aid course. He's recycled. He's done all of these things. And the Boy Scouts have said, "Okay, when you get enough merit here, you can go to the next level. And when you get enough merit here, you can go to the next level." And so he wants to be an Eagle Scout, and he completes this great, big, huge project. And the Boy Scouts say, "You've earned it. You've earned it." There is not going to be a Scoutmaster around who says, "By the grace of the Boy Scout organization, this has been earned." I'm fearful sometimes that's our view of religion. That somehow I'm going to show up on the day of judgment with my sash on. And I'm going to say, "Lord, I have earned my place in heaven. By the way, didn't you see when I was doing all these good deeds along the way, all these good things?" And I'm not looking at it as justified by God trying to be like Him. I'm viewing it on the other side of being justified by me writ merit. And I can say, "Lord, I've done this, and I've done this, and I've done this, and I've done this, and I can be saved." That's not how it works. And all of it really comes down to my attitude. Am I seeking to earn or am I seeking to obey? Am I seeking to present myself to the Lord and say, Lord, I have got it right? Or do I fall before the Lord and say, I am forgiven only by your grace? And the entirety of my life, I want to spend being like you. Am I seeking justification by self or by grace? It is a miserable, miserable religion that seeks self-justification. Because I am going to be reminded on a very regular basis of just what a failure I am. And there are a lot of people who spend miserable decades of their lives trying to earn their way to heaven and never appreciating the fact that it is only by the grace of God, through obedient faith, that we find that salvation. Because such a one never fully understands he paid the price. He provided the justification. It's through him we find forgiveness. And when I commit that first sin, there is nothing else for me but to fall at his mercy and beg for his grace. But what a wonderful Father we have who picks us up and dusts us off and says, welcome to the family. That's what God will do for us. What I've talked about this evening in brevity is something that has plagued religious thinkers for centuries. But I want us to understand it's really not that complicated. God has said you can't save yourself. God has said it is impossible because all have sinned, but I am here for you. And if you come to me in belief and you are buried in the waters of baptism for salvation, you can be saved. And that bearing in the waters of baptism is no more work than anything else is, because I don't think I'm earning a thing. I'm not going to put the baptism badge on my sash and say to God, look at me, what I've done. It is obedient faith that just as Abraham went when God said go, I'm baptized when God says to do it. And through His grace, I'm raised from those waters, my sins forgiven. Isn't that something you desire? It's a life then that you will live not of ignoring the ways of God, of saying it really doesn't matter what I do. It's a life live of being very conscientious about actions, not because we're trying to present ourselves perfect to God, but because we're trying to be holy as He is holy. And when I do that, God will welcome me home, saved by the blood of His Son, a faithful servant who can now bask in the holiness of God for eternity.